you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
This is Bill Press and Friends on the District Productive Network.
Here's where we start today, and I want to get your take on this, too. We start today on the resurgence of the oil and gas lobby. Yeah, you thought the fossil fuel industry was dead? No freaking way. They rule in the Trump administration, folks. Now, as we get into this, I got to tell you, I got a thing about oil, big oil companies, okay, about the fossil fuel industry. And now I know my daddy had a gas station, and I pumped gas with him. So, you know, in a sense, I come from big oil. Yeah, but my father wasn't making much money running a little gas station up in Delaware City, Delaware. But I've been against these big oil companies ever since I've been involved in politics, particularly since on environmental politics, for a very simple reason. Because they are the number one polluters of the environment. They don't give a damn. They just care about the bottom line. They have destroyed many beautiful areas of this country. You know, I'm from California with the oil spill in Santa Barbara, and the oil spills all up and down the coast. And I've fought them politically ever since I've been involved in politics. I even led an initiative campaign in California to tax the profits, excess profits of the oil companies, and put that into mass transit, public transportation. So I've taken on the oil companies for a long time. So I just want you to know, I want to acknowledge I have a certain bias when it comes to the oil and gas industry. But we thought that they're, and of course, they ruled this country at one time. After the railroads, it was the oil and gas industry. And we thought that their power lately had diminished a little bit. After all, most Americans, I think, recognize, and even politicians recognizing, we have to move away from fossil fuels. They're running out anyway. They are dirty. They pollute the environment. Yeah, the oil chieftains don't really care about clean air and clean water. All they care about is the bottom line. And so we're moving away from that, particularly under the leadership of President Obama. And we're moving more into renewable energy sources, more into solar, more into wind, into conservation, all kinds of exciting things going on. New CAFE standards for cars that get us up to like 55 miles per gallon. I mean, really making a lot of progress and seeing the decline of the oil and gas industry. Well, guess what? That is reversed already. Donald Trump has put the oil and gas lobby in charge of his new administration in many specific ways. I mean, look at his appointments. Number one, Mr. Oil and Gas himself, the head of ExxonMobil, as our next Secretary of State. And you say, well, that just has to do with treaties and stuff like that. No, no, no. John Kerry was the principal architect of the Paris Climate Accord agreements. So in this age of globalization, you know, it's not just the United States taking care of our little corner of the planet in terms of protecting the environment. We're all working together worldwide. To save the planet. And Rex Tillerson, oil man, is now going to be in charge of those efforts. And then he's backed up by Scott Pruitt, the new head of the EPA. He comes right out of the fossil fuel industry. As Attorney General of Oklahoma, he has fought for them. He has sued the EPA we've talked about. He's a climate change denier. He's going to try to reverse everything EPA has done, particularly on the new regulations for coal-fired power plants. And then on top of that, you've now got this guy, Ryan Zinke, congressman from Montana, who's Mr. Coal, been honored and received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the coal industry in Montana. He's going to be the new Secretary of the Interior. He's all for drilling on public lands. And then on top of that, you got Rick Perry as the new Secretary of Energy. And Rick Perry, of course, Mr. Texas, Mr. Oil and Gas, so right down the line. And what can we expect? And on top of that, you know, you got Donald Trump, who doesn't come from the oil industry, but has put these people in charge. And, you know, he's laissez-faire, Mr. Big Business, let them do whatever they want. So we can expect a full onslaught against all the progress we've made over the last 8 or 10 years. A full onslaught meaning reversing the Paris Climate Accord agreements, probably rolling back the new the CAFE standards on new cars and trucks. Keystone Pipeline, you bet it's going to come back. This Dakota Pipeline, you bet that latest decision of the Corps of Engineers is going to be reversed under these guys. Anything to do clean air, clean water, new regulations, all this protection which President Obama was able to get through EPA or through the Congress are going to be reversed. It is and that means also new drilling. There's a ban now on drilling up in certain very sensitive areas of the Arctic. Forget about it. They'll be going up there full speed ahead. A ban on drilling all down the west coast of the United States, from Washington State all the way down to San Diego. Forget about it. They're going to try to get in there and reopen that drilling. I think the new Attorney General of California, Javier Becerra, will fight them every step of the way. So will Governor Jerry Brown, of course. But they'll come after it. Same thing on the east coast of the United States, and same thing in the Gulf. You know, that deep water drilling, which has been more restrained since the big BP blowout. No, these guys are just full speed ahead. It is going to be absolute blank check, absolute green light for oil and gas development and coal and mining in this country under the leadership of these guys. And, of course, behind them all, you've talked about oil and gas money. The Koch brothers, that is their agenda. And we've talked about that before, too. That when you hear the Koch brothers giving all this money in politics, they're not doing it because they want good government. They're doing it because they are the biggest fossil fuel company in the world. And they want, I mean, Charles Koch has said that. They want to do away with EPA. They want to do away with the Department of Interior. They want zero. They want to do away with all government regulations over the oil and gas industry. That's why they have pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into Republican campaign coffers, and they are finally going to get their day. And they're behind every one of these politicians. I'm telling you, this is the bad news. And, of course, climate change is overall going to be the big loser, because you've got Donald Trump, the climate denier in chief, now surrounded by Rick Perry, climate denier, Ryan Zinke, climate denier. Scott Pruitt, climate change denier, and Rex Tillerson and his position. People say, well, he can't be so bad because he thinks that he's not for repealing the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Yeah, but this is ExxonMobil, who haven't seen the figures for this year, but in ExxonMobil's last report, which came out in July, through 2015, they were still the chief funder of climate change denial organizations like the American Enterprise Institute and the American Legislative Exchange Council. So Rex Tillerson's position, actually, on climate change, when he was asked about it, is he says it's not a serious problem. It's just an engineering problem that we can fix. That's how he dismisses the whole thing of climate change. So I'm telling you, if you care about the environment, you care about clean air, you care about clean water, this is going to be a very, very dangerous time. The man who is leading Bernie Sanders' team and our revolution, chairman of the board of our revolution, our good friend Larry Cohen, former president of the Communication Workers of America, up early this morning and at it.
Always up early.
Hey, Larry, you're looking good.
Yeah, right.
This is a very exciting time. I mean, our revolution, I've said other presidential candidates, some didn't even try. Some have tried to form an organization to continue their agenda. Mm-hmm. I think if anybody can pull it off, Bernie Sanders can, with all the support that he had around the country. How's it going?
Great. We did a live stream last night with Bernie introducing Keith Ellison, running for Democratic Party chair. 200,000 people watched.
That's great.
We did it at the American Federation of Teachers, packed room. Very exciting, as you said. You know, sobering time on the one hand with what might be the worst president ever. But on the other hand, it's a time to stand up and fight back, and people are doing it.
So Bernie had, what, something like 8 million contributions from 2.5 million contributors, if I recall. Is that the
yeah,
right?
That's close. Around, in the 2.5 million contributors, $250 million.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the number of contributions, but yeah.
But how, so I was just wondering about, with this vast, vast support that he had among the American people, have they now, like, or signed up for our revolution, continuing the...
They have not all signed up, shockingly, but many have signed up. Lots are active. Over 600,000 signed petitions so far for Keith Ellison, which we will split up by states. So, for example, 100,000 from California alone, and we'll say to the state party chair, okay, which side are you on? You're going to stand with 100,000, and it'll grow quickly. 100,000 or more people, are you going to be part of the old guard, just following along the W. Wasserman Schultz trajectory as Democrats plunge into the basement across the country?
All right. So you've touched on both things. I want to ask you about two big issues, and they're related, obviously. One is, what do you tell all the Bernie Sanders supporters? How do we progressives respond, react to the incoming Trump administration, number one? And two, how do we recharge, rebuild, redirect the Democratic Party? As I say, they're very related. But let's start with, what do progressives do about this Trump? You see, as I mentioned at the top, appointing all these oil and gas people in charge. Everything we care about, he's got people going in the opposite direction. What do we do?
Right. So I think it's a combination of resistance, which is, you know, somewhat complex. It ranges from sanctuary and actually protecting each other, not self-defense, I like to say, mutual aid. If we wait and they come for people one at a time, we'll all go down the drain. So what does mutual aid mean? Whether it's unions under attack, and unions will get blistered right off the bat here. There's two vacancies on the NLRB. He gets control immediately. Whether it's immigrants, people of the Muslim faith, LGBT or transgender, what does mutual aid mean? How do we defend each other? But also stay on offense. What is our vision that we heard in the Bernie campaign? How do we deal with the worst inequality ever in the richest country in the world? How do we stay on the attack in terms of expanding Medicare, not just resisting cuts, expanding opportunities about higher ed instead of the trillion dollars in student debt growing to $2 trillion? So staying on offense, but also not taking our eye off the kind of resistance and mutual aid, collective self-defense, sanctuary that we will need when he attacks us.
And what's the venue? Is it Congress? Is it state legislatures? Is it local government?
All. So it's definitely all of those. So this notion of sanctuary or building bases around the country is definitely local government. So even in this election, lots of examples from the Our Revolution ranks, people getting elected. Chris Schwartz in Black Hawk County supervisor, or just yesterday, Julie Nitsch in Austin, Texas, won a runoff for Board of Trustees, Austin Community College. So I think, you know, there are places like this where we can build out, and those people have great vision in terms of what they can do where they live. But also back here, it'll be more of putting forward an alternative vision, like on infrastructure, not, as you said, a fossil fuel infrastructure, which is what Trump will bring, but instead infrastructure based on a green economy, the same kind of vision that a Bernie or even a Hillary Clinton would have fought for had they been president. So I think we have to do both. Here's our vision. Keep organizing around on a national level, but on a local level, people can govern in some cities and towns. We should look for those, and we should build out.
So you're saying that even with Trump in the White House, Republicans in control of the House and the Congress and most governorships, there are still opportunities.
Yeah, huge opportunities, you know, all over the country. We have to look for those. And your second question, in the Democratic Party.
Right.
So one of the things our revolution is doing is helping people take over precinct chairs. So right now in Florida, the deadline is today. There's thousands across the country of open precinct seats. Basically, you can sign up and you'll be the precinct chair, and then you get involved on the county level. So reorganizing the Democratic Party from the bottom at the same time that we fight for Keith Ellison at the top. And we're actually better because of the way the party is structured. I am a delegate, a DNC member, and have been there for 12 years. But because of the way it's structured, the real path to change is at the precinct level, and then the county level, and then the state level, and then we change the DNC. Hopefully, Keith, we can also elect Keith along the way. As I said, 600,000 people have already signed up for Keith, and we're going to take those names and that support to every state chair.
Right. Today, it's good that you're here today, because today, Keith Ellison, who was first one out there, certainly the front runner, co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, big supporter of Bernie Sanders. We support Keith Ellison. But he's going to get a big challenge today. Labor Secretary Tom Perez is going to announce that he's going to run against Keith. Why?
Well, that's the question I asked in a column published yesterday. Why would he run? Because he's certainly not running to say, hey, I'm the more progressive candidate. He's obviously going to run to the right of Keith Ellison. We want him to own that if he's actually going to announce that he's running today rather than exploring it. We want him to own why he's doing that, so that some of the donors that spoke out against Keith, like Sabin, they'll be happy to see Tom Perez. We're not happy. We don't think the donors like Sabin should have much of a voice in this party. They should be, like the rest of us, an active citizen, that the amount of money you give shouldn't control the party. Again, I've been on there for 12 years. I'm sick and tired of it. That's what I've seen for 12 years. It's all about finance. It's all about rich donors. It's all about candidates that'll fund their own elections. As Fannie Lou Hamer said, sick and tired of being sick and tired. That's what's wrong with this Democratic Party. Either it changes now or it risks any kind of viability going forward.
Is this a rift between the Sanders wing of the party now and the Clinton-Obama wing?
I don't think it's exactly that. Lots of unions. We were at AFT last night where we broadcast. Randy Weingarten kicked off that event. She was obviously a
big
core supporter
of
Hillary Clinton.
Yes,
and
right.
Now of Keith Ellison. The same thing with AFSCME. And most unions are supporting Keith. So that's one example.
Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME,
correct,
supported Hillary. I think they were the first union. No, AFT was the first.
Yeah.
But AFSCME was early on with
early
Hillary.
Early on, not quite.
Right. And now supporting Keith Ellison.
Correct.
Right. So,
and it's not just the unions. Chuck Schumer, who was a core supporter of Hillary Clinton, core supporter of Keith Ellison. Mayor de Blasio announced yesterday that he's supporting Keith Ellison. Elizabeth Warren, who stayed neutral, mm-hmm. supporting Keith Ellison. There's quite a list.
Right. But I guess you'd have to say, I mean, Perez is a progressive, right? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a progressive. He's not done grassroots party work in the way that Keith Ellison has. He did get elected Montgomery County Council. As I said in my column, he was an excellent labor secretary. But the point is, do we want change or continuity? Obviously, he has to run as continuity. He was a supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Most Democrats abhor the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We celebrated its defeat while he was continuing the campaign for it. So really, it's a matter of visuals. Do we want more continuity? The White House has run that party for 8 years. This president's beloved by me and others, but frankly ran the party into the ground. The DNC is all but dead, and we need a new DNC. We need a symbol of real change. That's Keith Ellison.
All right. Now, let's say we've got Keith Ellison, head of the DNC. What changes do you think we need to see in the Democratic Party to reflect more of what you and I think the Democratic Party ought to be all about?
Yeah, number one, not in a symbolic way, but in a real way, open, transparent discussion, debate, no more of the, all the way to the top at the DNC level. Again, I've been there 12 years. The only time any of us got to speak is when we literally took the microphone and demanded it. We marched to the microphone and took it over. There has not been one opportunity for anybody to comment on a single thing on the 12 years I've been there. There's been no transparency about the elections. The structure of the party needs to change. I'm the vice chair of what will be starting up soon, the Unity Reform Commission, which is to look at the party. And obviously, I'm on there solely because of Bernie Sanders. It was a convention resolution agreement in Philadelphia instead of a floor fight on the rules. But from the rules of the party at the national level, how presidents get nominated, to how the party operates in Florida, for example, where they're reorganizing now. Disgrace is the only word I could use to describe what's going on in Florida, how they organize. It's totally obscure, no transparency. We need to change that in every state, in every county. We need to say to the ward bosses, your day is over. The people of this country, young people, they need to believe that they can come in and play a role in this party now, not that they wait and wait and wait.
How about closed primaries?
Closed primaries is another problem. I mean, that's now you're into a long conversation for me.
I know, but
it's a whole, I mean, yeah, how presidents get nominated is a gigantic problem. The New York primary, you had to be a registered Democrat 195 days before the election. 195 days was Halloween, and yeah, it was a scary holiday and trick or treat, but that's not the way that the New York primary should run. And young people thought they were eligible to vote for Bernie Sanders all over New York State. It turned out they weren't.
Yeah, I forget how many hundreds of thousands of voters at the time. Now, I don't see how any Democrat, any progressive certainly can defend a closed primary.
Well, it goes on and on, the Iowa caucus. I mean, it was basically a tie, but we really won that, the Bernie Sanders side. You couldn't get a count. The count doesn't exist, except the state party chair had the count of, I forget how many, 1,666 caucuses, 99 counties. You couldn't get a count of how many people showed up in any of the rooms. And it was based on those counts that the county convention delegates were then decided. Again, it's a process that you couldn't invent, except we already have it.
Hey, everybody, this is Bill Press. Thanks for listening to the Bill Press and Friends podcast. And now, do yourself a favor. If you haven't already done so, subscribe to the show on iTunes. Here's what you do. Just search for the Bill Press Show. Then you can take us with you and listen in anywhere you go. And you'll get new shows from us as soon as they're posted. And one more thing. If you really enjoy Bill Press and Friends, please help us grow by telling a friend, writing a review, and giving us a rating on iTunes. It's so great to have you on board. Many thanks. Welcome to the program. I think our first visit in studio here. Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty from the great state of Connecticut. Hello, Congresswoman. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Bill. Great to be with you.
Well, Congresswoman, we know that members of Congress are out of town. You are here in Washington for a very sad but very important reason. Yesterday marking, believe it or not, the fourth anniversary of Sandy Hook, which is in your district.
Yeah.
26 people killed at that school that morning. 20 first graders, which is just still hard to believe. And how are the families? You were with some of them last night. How are they coping?
Well,
and how's the community coping?
Well, there's a range. You know, there's a range. It is astounding to me that it's been 4 years, and I was just newly elected to Congress.
You weren't even yet sworn in.
Not
correct?
Sworn in. I was with a bipartisan group of members at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard on our very last day of new member training. We had 3 weeks of training in various places that last day, and I started, my phone started blowing up, and I ended up by noon throwing my stuff in a car and driving straight to the firehouse and meeting for the first time these people I've now gotten to know incredibly well. And just to share with you, just the, if you think about this time of year, the voice that really strikes with me, because I could hear from the other room where the governor was notifying families, and at that point it was about 4 o'clock, and I remember one mother screaming, she was sick, she didn't want to go to school, I made her go, I wanted to go Christmas shopping, and if I'd let her stay home, she'd be alive now. So you think about what that, and I don't know which parent that was, but I know these parents now, and it just, as a mom of three, it's still shattering to me every time I think about that. And I can't go through Sandy Hook without visualizing that day, what I saw over the next few weeks. So the community is incredibly resilient, and I think that's important to know. The elected officials, local folks, really stepped up. The religious community, people have been unbelievably caring and gracious with each other. So the hard work they've done together to knit that community back together is remarkable. And there are national leaders who have really grown out of that group. Some of them directly parents who lost children. Some you've seen, like Mark Barden, who's worked very closely with the president, who lost his son Daniel. Mm-hmm. And another thing to know is that a number of these children were on the autism spectrum. Actually, these are two classrooms that had aides in them, and that's part of the reason there were so many teachers. aides who were helping these children, because a number of them were autistic or on the autism spectrum. So it's a particular heartbreak, and there have been outreach in that community. People have formed family foundations looking at brain research, for example. The Richmond family, he's a postdoc chemist, and he's given up his work to form a foundation on brain research. Jimmy Green, whose daughter was killed, he's a Grammy-winning recording artist. He has donated songs and sings. So the outpouring of positive response is incredible. And in some ways, the most remarkable thing is that I think it's now 6 children have been born to these families.
Oh, is that
since
right?
Annie Hook. Yeah. So when I think, when people think it's too hard, we need to give up, I think if those families can choose to bring new life into this world, having seen the worst face of evil, the rest of us can suck it up and get our jobs done. You know, however hard Congress it is, and it isn't as hard as what these families deal with every day, and yet they found a way to go forward, and they found a way to be hopeful, and they found a way to look forward to the future. And that, I have to say, that inspires me every day.
But what must be frustrating is that there, for you and for all of us, is there have been such a positive response outpouring from inside the community and from outside the community toward the people of Newtown, and yet no response at all from this Congress in terms of the gun violence.
Well, in the House, we haven't even had a single hearing on a single bill, not a single vote, which is why we took to the floor of the House.
Yes.
You know, my colleague and actually neighbor of a block and a half away, Chris Murphy, got it started with this 15-hour filibuster. And then we in the House were not going to sit by. Mm-hmm. And we knew we were breaking rules, but that's sometimes what you have to do. And,
good trouble.
Exactly.
John
as John Lewis
it.
Says, sometimes
goodness,
you got to get
in trouble.
Yeah, you got to get in trouble, got to get in some good trouble. And that was sort of my grandmother's philosophy, too, was active on civil rights.
I remember the families coming down here from Newtown and walking the halls and talking to people. And you just thought that there's no way they can deny those voices. There's no way they can. And yet they did.
They did. And it's still sort of shocking to me as a matter of humanity. But I am a hopeful person, and I think rather than getting the change right away at the top, which is what we were hoping for to push to leadership at the national level, we're clearly going to have to be pushing from the state level. That's what's been happening. 3 of the 4 ballot initiatives in the U.S. in this crazy election in November, 3 of the 4 for more gun safety passed. So I think we're going to see it coming from the bottom up. And I do believe this is going to change. And frankly, you know, I think Donald Trump has an opportunity and a challenge. It's a Nixon to China possible moment. He says he wants a safer America. He says he's a law and order president. Well, why do you think we're seeing so many deaths in the inner cities and so many shootings of police officers? They're washing guns. You ask police officers.
Sure.
Washing guns. It's not a federal felony to traffic in firearms across state lines. It is to traffic in tainted milk, a federal felony. It is not to take weapons across state lines. That's crazy.
Yeah.
We know most of the weapons recovered at crime scenes are from a handful of federally licensed firearms dealers. We should shut them down. So I am going to make no... I have no qualms about going to talk to the president-elect or once he's sworn in and said, you not only have an opportunity, you have an obligation to follow through on these promises.
But one of his proudest moments, you know, he talks about all the time, is when he was endorsed by the NRA and he basically told them, I'm your guy. Anything you want, I'm with you.
Well, I'll tell you.
It'd be hard to get him to turn. You're right. The opportunity is there.
Well, I'll tell you.
It's going to be a tough challenge, Congresswoman.
In 2013, the NRA, Chris Cox and some other NRA top folks sat in a conference room with me and a couple of other members of Congress writing the legislation on comprehensive background checks. We had them at the table. They used to back this, frankly, until they saw that it might pass. And then they backed away. So this historically, you look at historically.
And their membership would support
it. Their membership supports it over 80%.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, seriously, you want to keep guns out of the hands of bad guys, out of the hands of people who would hurt themselves or others. And let's not forget, 2/3 of the deaths, talking about 33,000 a year, 33,000 a year, 120,000 Americans in the 4 years since Sandy Hook and Congress hasn't taken any action. Now, if that were Ebola, if that were, look what we're talking about with Syria, right? And yet it is normal in this country we do this. It's normal. Japan had 6 gun deaths. 6. You can count them on 2 hands in a year. We have a town, the equivalent of the town I live in, Cheshire, Connecticut, more people than live in the town I live in, gone every single year. We can do better. We have to do better. It's just, it's completely unacceptable that this is considered normal. No other country has this.
When you...
That's so sobering. I mean, if you think about if we were in a war...
Right.
And we lost that many Americans...
Yes.
I mean, that we would be in the streets... Totally. Knocking down the doors of every elected official and demanding that this end.
I mean, Vietnam.
I mean, when you put it that way, it just blows my mind.
You know, 55,000 in Vietnam over the course of that war.
Yeah.
And you look at the trauma, and yet this happens every single day in America. So we lose 20,000 veterans a day, almost every single one of them with a gun. Now, what are we doing? Not enough. Clearly not enough. If this is our best effort, it's pretty bad, right? We get an F.
I have to ask you, now you've been reelected twice?
Right, just reelected.
So what kind of opposition do you find and face from the NRA when you stand with this position on gun safety in your district?
Well, I have a big gun district.
They target you?
I have a big gun district.
Yeah.
I do. They make guns in my district. I mean, Connecticut was the home of Colt and Winchester. I mean, that's part of the core of Connecticut's economy. Originally, actually, was arms manufacture. Ironically, the national sponsor of gun shows is based in Newtown. The National Shooting Sports Federation,
really?
NSSF, which sponsors almost all the gun shows in America, is based in Newtown, Connecticut.
Wow. Yeah.
So just think about that.
Think about that. Okay.
So well, yes,
so
I do
back
get
to you. The question.
Yeah, I do
they
get
must
opposition.
Come after you.
They do. You know, they recognize it's challenging, but they send out mailers and they have recruited candidates, and a lot of it's misinformation.
So you just squeak through?
No, not this time. My first election, yes. And the margin keeps getting bigger. So I won by 50,000 votes this time. So it didn't work. And I have a lot of support with
but that's
veterans.
That's so important to know that people can stand
Absolutely.
Up and be for reasonable gun safety measures and still get reelected. You have to tell more Democrats that, Congressman.
I do every day. And I'll tell you, having lost my seat in the state legislature over my opposition to the death penalty, a core part of my support right now are first responders. A lot of cops and firefighters who tell me, like, I didn't support you back when you were opposing the death penalty. But you know what? You're a stand-up person. You say what you're going to do. You believe in it. And we want that. We want people who care and who are tough. And I'm in fact, talking to a bunch of new members of Congress just elected. Tell them, you ran for a reason. It's really hard.
Yeah.
Stand up for what you believe in. And you know what? That is what people are looking for. If you should learn nothing from this election. People want that authenticity. They know they're not always going to agree with you. They know that. But they want to know who you are, what you believe. And I deeply believe that. And besides, you got to look yourself in the mirror. You got to look history in the mirror. You got to face your own children with what you're doing or not doing.
It's kind of like, you know, we have this choice. You can either go for a little bit of change or you could go for a drastic change.
Or you can put your head under the desk and hope
or you can
that,
do that
the
yes,
storm
of course.
Blows
yeah,
over.
You can also do that. You can also do that. But I mean, I guess if there's any lesson to be learned from the way that Donald Trump won, right, is that you can run on significant change that is maybe a little unknown, right? Like, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with him, but like, you can swing for the fences. You could change as drastically, you could propose as drastic a change as you want to make, and people will go there if they agree with that idea. And so these little tiny incremental changes on gun control and gun safety, you got to really go big, I think. You really got to go big for these. And so I think you're on the right path.
I think you got to believe in what you're fighting for.
That too.
I mean, honestly, let's talk about it, which is not necessarily true.
No,
Mr.
That's
Trump.
That's what we won't
But people
take from
do
him.
Want change,
yeah.
And people are frustrated with gridlock. I will tell you that. I heard that all over my district. I was like, just get something done.
Right.
And I would say, like, look, these are the things I am getting done. They're like, okay, well, we recognize you're trying. We know you care. You're out there every day. And, you know, to some extent, if you have to both simultaneously swing for the fences and also take the gains that you get.
Sure,
as you
yes,
go.
Of
and,
course.
And lock
yeah.
them in.
Yeah.
And lock them in as you go. So it's I mean, it's a process, but, man, you know, it's not going to change if we don't try.
Switch back to politics now with our good friend, political reporter for MSNBC, Alex Seitzwald, joining us in the studio. Hello, Alex. How are
you?
Hey,
Bill. Good.
So, Alex, what's going to be like for the media under this new administration?
I mean, you know, I think the prison newspaper and the reporter's concentration camp is going to be stellar. You know, the 10-time winning, 10-time Pulitzer Prize winning Sing Sing Gazette is going to be great. But before we get there, hopefully, you know, hopefully we won't get there. But I don't know. I mean, you know, there was talk yesterday about rearranging the way the White House Correspondents Association works.
In fact, Ryan Priebus, the incoming chief of staff, was talking to Hugh Hewitt yesterday in his program, didn't mince any bones about the fact that, you know, we don't feel compelled to hold daily White House briefings. Here he is.
You know, even looking at things like the daily White House briefing from the press secretary, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that things can be done, and I can assure you we're looking at that.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
I mean, there's no
law. What am I going to do with 3 hours every day? I can't go to the briefing. Yeah.
There's nothing is sacred in the Trump administration and the Trump White House. All these norms and these ways that things have been done for years and years and traditions that have been respected are being reevaluated. And there's no law that requires the president to do this. But it comes, you know, in the context of every administration being less accessible to the press and therefore to the public than previous administrations. And I'm guessing we're going to take a giant leap forward on that front with this one.
Backwards, I would say.
Well, right, depending on which way you want to.
Yeah, I mean, clearly President Obama was less accessible, believe it or not, than George W. Bush was.
Yep.
Or he and the people around him and his administration. I mean, I've only been there under President Obama, but my colleagues down there tell me they had a lot more access under W than they did under President Obama. And it's going to be worse under President Trump.
Yeah, and it's natural that, you know, if you're the president, you don't want pesky reporters running around. But there's usually somebody in your inner circle who can push back on that and can say, this is important. You know, both from a Democratic point of view and politically, like Hillary Clinton, when they first came to the White House with Bill Clinton in 92, she wanted to shut down this doorway that leads from the press briefing room to the West Wing of the White House, where reporters can kind of wander through.
Right, right.
And George Stephanopoulos, who was the press secretary, then said, no way. You know, he put the kibosh on that immediately. Who inside Trump's circle is going to be sticking up for the press? I can't think of anyone.
No.
Right. And the question is that Susan Page from USA Today made this point earlier in our program, that they have to realize, one would hope, that the briefings are not just important for reporters or for the American people, but they're important for the administration itself as a vehicle for getting their message out in a very focused, disciplined way every day, where they're really in charge. I mean, they're at the podium. We can ask pesky questions, to use your word, right? But ultimately, it's their forum.
Right. I mean, it's free, you know, a place to spout what you want to say, to your talking points, to try to, you know, get tough questions that you are anticipating because they're going to be out there and trying to, you know, spin them, provide new information to the press, or talk about things that are not getting covered that you want to be put on the radar. Trump is obviously, with Twitter, you know, taken a different approach to that, and maybe he feels like he can just get his message out and you know, do what he needs to do on that approach. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see something kind of unprecedented, and he just calls in as from, you know, the Oval Office to Fox News and does phoner interviews because, you know, why not? Because he can do whatever he wants.
The Parting Shot with Bill Press. This is the Bill Press Show.
Yeah, a parting shot. All we got is a chance to make the point we made earlier in the show, which is that the big loser in this election turns out to be climate change. Look at it. Donald Trump, who says climate change is a hoax on top, and then joined now by Rex Tillerson at State and Rick Perry at Energy and Scott Pruitt at EPA and Ryan Zinke at Interior, all climate change deniers. It is the planet, it is humanity that is going to suffer. Hopefully only for 4 years. That's it, folks, for today. Come back tomorrow. We'll be looking for you. Have a good one.
This is the Bill Press Show.